This is Kate Harness with 307 Net Radio, and today I'm joined by Terry Markham, who's Director of Uprising. Hello, Terry. Nice to see you. How are you?
I'm really good. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me. Trafficking, human trafficking, is an issue which we've suddenly found very high on our agenda. There's a movie out. We're not going to talk about the movie itself, Sound of Freedom. We're not going to discuss that. What we're going to do is have a conversation about Uprising, the organization that's here. You're based in Sheridan County, but you operate across our Wyoming region, I know. And really just to give some context for what trafficking might look like in Johnson and Sheridan counties and what people need to know. What are the things that you talk about every day? And, you know, what is the information that is relevant to local people, especially to parents who may be concerned or maybe just to anybody who wants to keep themselves safe? So thank you for a moment. Tell us a little bit about Uprising.
Sure. Well, Uprising is an anti-human trafficking nonprofit that we're actually about to have our fourth birthday next month. So we're still pretty new. But it really started because I've been in this field for about 11 to 12 years now. I'm from San Antonio, Texas, and I got into human trafficking work when I was down there, and I used to work on a sort of a support team for women in the sex industry. And I started to see human trafficking right in front of my face. And it was nothing like what was in my head, the picture in my head of what trafficking was.
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think, you know, we'll come back in a minute to talk about human trafficking in Wyoming. Do we really put that together? But what do you mean when you say human trafficking? What should people be understanding about that term?
Well, I think what people don't realize, what it really comes down to, is someone who is really being exploited, typically for labor or for sex. And most people have these grand pictures in their head because of, well, honestly, it's a lot of the stuff we take in about human trafficking is very sensationalized. You know, you think like the big picture movies, you know, the things like Taken and stuff, those are like what people think in their head. Or they think the white van snatching kids off street corners, or people zip tying your windshield wiper in the parking lot of Walmart. But we rarely, if ever, see cases like that locally. And when I say locally, not even just in Wyoming, but even my work in Texas, what it really came down to was something that was right in front of my face all along that I didn't realize. It was just a person who was being forced to do sex acts in exchange for something of value, or a person who was being forced to work for little or no pay, or pay that wasn't a fair, livable wage.
So they could still be living in their own neighborhood, maybe even their own home, but for some reason or other, they have no free will and have been coerced into doing something that they don't want to do.
Absolutely. I see a lot of cases like that.
How does that happen? I mean, I think, you know, most people would say, well, why does she let that go on? Who are the people who are doing this? And how old, you know, is there a typical person who becomes trafficked? And is there a typical trafficker? How does that come about?
I mean, the one thing I will say about human trafficking is it's a very broad spectrum. Within, just in the U.S. alone, there's about 25 different types of human trafficking that have been identified here. And so there's a lot of different ways this can look. Most of the survivors I work with, like, none of their stories are exactly the same. So it can be very vastly different. But, I mean, one of the things that I've seen most commonly here locally is, like, familial trafficking, where it's a family member who's trafficking you.
So how does that come about? It's almost incomprehensible to some people that you would traffic, you know, a parent or would traffic your child in some way. How does that happen?
Usually there's a very huge addiction or need. So the two most common scenarios I've seen with familial trafficking, where it's a parent trafficking child, is usually that parent is addicted to a substance, and the only way they can get their next high is by selling their child, or poverty. That's literally how they put the next meal on the table. As a matter of fact, I when Uprising was first getting started, one of the first cases that I was told about that was an active case at the time was out of Johnson County, and I believe it was an 8-year-old boy who was being trafficked by his family. So I've heard that over and over. And if you even, a lot of times it's not reported as trafficking. Sometimes those cases aren't even filed as trafficking, like under the statutes. They're not filing them away as like a trafficking case. They use oftentimes a lot of other charges that they feel they can really actually put that person away and get justice in that case. But if you just do a little bit of looking and know what you're looking for, it's incredible how much of this is happening across Wyoming.
So let's try and talk some numbers. And I would have thought that's very difficult because reporting is problematic in itself. And there's the whole nature of trafficking is that it does go under the radar or unnoticed. And maybe it's happening right under somebody's nose, but they don't know what they're really looking at. I would imagine there's a certain amount of fear and aggression involved, maybe some physical violence too, mm-hmm. just to kind of make sure that, victims are silent.
Yep.
And so on. So reporting is incredibly difficult. But do you have any sense of how big an issue this is for us?
You're absolutely right. It's incredibly difficult to quantify how much this is happening. But there is one group within our state who I think is doing such incredible work that I often turn to them when we're trying to showcase like just how big this problem is, and people might not realize, and that's our Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. They are primarily working with exploited children only via one means. It has to be internet involvement for this, but last year alone, they had nearly 800 cyber tips that they had to investigate. And this is a team of 6 core people and then some affiliates. I mean, we're talking 20-ish people throughout the state who are working on over 800 tips. And they had over 30 rescues of children in our state who were actively being exploited in Wyoming, and multiple arrests of people who were either abusing those children and producing content with them or were consuming the content.
And of course, I think it's worth pointing out, I know that task force has sort of exponentially, that their workload has risen dramatically, mm-hmm. Over the past few years, obviously with the rise of internet, the amount of cell phone and internet access and so on, and the privacy that some people can get through that. But it's not just pornography online, it's not just sexual acts in person, it's a combination of all of those mm-hmm. things, and those things may be, feeling themselves, that you may have somebody who's actually perpetrating on another person who is unwilling to do that, but they then may also be selling images or video of that on as well. So there's lots of aspects.
And when it comes to something like that, whenever... I mean, I like to think of human trafficking, especially sex trafficking, there's almost a formula. You need any sex act in exchange for anything of value where a third party is profiting off of that exchange. So that formula right there, it could look like a youth who's online and meets someone who gains their trust, who eventually coerces them into sending illicit photos or videos, and then they turn around and they're selling that. That youth may never know that they're even being victimized, but every single time that picture or that video is reshared and consumed by someone else, that kid's literally being re-trafficked and re-trafficked and re-trafficked. And that's the kind of stuff that those ICAC agents are dealing with every day, and they're just absolutely inundated with it. And that's just one aspect of online. So online trafficking, obviously huge now with the way technology leads in all of our lives. But there's so many other types too where it's happening more in person, physical, like the picture in most people's heads.
Sure. And of course, there's a whole other place called the dark web where things really do happen in the shadows. And even if you think that you may have reclaimed some of those images that have got out there and so on. And I know they do a lot of work on trying to get those images taken down and out of distribution and so on. That is by no means successful. And mm-hmm. those things can then pop up again sometime in 20, 30 years. We have no idea what's coming.
Yeah, they never fully go away. I mean, an image has like a digital DNA. So once it's out there, someone with the right tools who wanted to recover it could absolutely recover it. So it's really, it's a difficult space to work in. And it's crucial part of our work that we do is trying to help empower youth with information so they know how to stay safer, so that they realize, you know, the repercussions and what can happen and how serious some of that is. And it's not just as simple as, like, sending a nude or something.
Sure, and you think that you're sending it to the boy you like, and the boy you like may not actually be the boy that you like. It may just be a photo, and he's just been really good at kind of concealing himself, and he may be somebody who looks completely different in some way, completely separate. And the chances of ever prosecuting or finding him, you know, are slim to none. And I know that there have been cases of sextortion like that in Johnson County, and, you know, they're incredibly damaging to everybody involved.
Yeah, and it's not getting any easier. It's getting more frightening, in my opinion, because it's getting harder and harder to trust who you're talking to. Like, before, where, you know, kids are like, well, I'll just ask them to get on camera then, and if they don't get on camera, then I know that they're fake. Well, now, have you seen, like, these deep fake things going around where people are making videos and they look exactly like a celebrity? You think, like, the celebrity is doing that. And
really turns out it really is Justin Bieber or Taylor Swift for you. Yes.
It's insane what you can do with technology now.
And, of course, you know, we are really only in the foothills of what artificial intelligence can do for us. So, you know, and it brings into massive questions trust. So, what can Uprising do, and what do you do, and what would you like people to know?
I think the biggest thing that we do is community education about what trafficking actually looks like here locally. And a big part of that is sort of undoing, like, the picture in people's heads, because we want to sort of myth bust and let people know, like, the thing that you probably think trafficking is you're probably looking at the wrong thing. And what it really looks like is these kids who are sitting in our classroom and that person who's walking down the street in your community. And so we do a lot of education about the different types of trafficking and cases that we have seen in Wyoming, the types of disclosures that we receive. We often try to bring survivors into communities to speak about their lived experience so people can learn from them. And then the other big thing that we do is prevention education. And so we do a lot of training directly with youth. And again, that's really, we try to keep that to be a very empowering space. We never want to go in and tell youth, like, this is dangerous, you don't need to be doing it, get off the internet. Like, you shouldn't have a phone, because we know that doesn't work. Instead, we try to have as much youth-led training as we can to where they are really telling us what they know, and then we empower them with even more. And we're like, oh, that's amazing, you know that. Did you also know this? And they really take to that. They understand that. They appreciate that approach where it's not just adults talking at them, but we're really trying to have a conversation that includes them. And then the same with parents and caregivers. I think that's a really key piece, because every parent at this point, I feel like, is a little bit terrified of especially the internet and the way exploitation can happen there. So we try to do a lot of training about how you can have these conversations with your kids and what are all the root causes before something gets to exploitation that you can start working with your kids on that are going to just drastically reduce the chances that they would ever even become a victim. Because when it comes down to it, these exploiters and these traffickers, they're really looking for vulnerabilities that they can exploit in these youth. And so if we empower our kids to understand their own selves better and to understand clear lines of consent and to know healthy boundaries and what healthy relationships look like, chances are they're not going to be that ideal victim who's preyed on in the first place. So that's what we do.
And Tara, you've been involved with us in with Lisa Norman and myself in bringing The Right Road, which is a program aimed at high schoolers. We bring it to Buffalo and we include neighboring school districts. And we've taken that piece that you outlined about actually trying to educate young people themselves and students themselves to kind of, you know, be more savvy. Not saying don't do this, just saying if you do this, these are the potential consequences. And so I'm looking forward to us doing that again this September. But to go back, you mentioned the kid in the classroom who may be subjected to this. Could you explain more about that and what we need to be looking for?
I mean, it's really hard to give a list of indicators. I will say that, because it can really be drastically different. And the indicators that someone could be exploited could also be indicators that a lot of different things are happening. But at the end of the day, I think one of the biggest things that you want to look for is a drastic change in behavior. Because if you have a kid, you know, who was maybe really social and suddenly they're isolating, they're pulling away, their grades are dropping, that could be a big indicator. On the opposite side, if you have a kid who was really sort of isolated to begin with, or sort of like a loner, someone who wasn't very social, and suddenly, you know, they have a social life, or they have a phone that they're constantly on, or they're wearing new sneakers and having new gifts and stuff that they're bringing to school, like that could be an indicator. Or a kid who's suddenly becoming more promiscuous even, or it could be the opposite. And so I like to think that change of behavior is usually a really key piece that something is probably going on with this kid. It doesn't necessarily mean trafficking, of course, but it's your cue to pay a little bit more attention and ask more questions. And a lot of the survivors who I know who were victimized as children often tell me about their experiences, like going to school, how they struggled with school because they were maintaining this whole second life that no one knew about that was primarily happening evenings and weekends. And so staying awake in class, or their parents sending in lots of excuses for why they were constantly missing school, things like that were the big indicators. So it's hard to, like, there's not a specific list you can ever give. A lot of it comes down to your gut. And just knowing that this can happen in your community, so that anytime something's off, you should take a closer look.
And is it just kids?
No, absolutely not. This can happen to anyone. I've met a lot of survivors here in Wyoming who've disclosed all different ages, all different types of trafficking. And so there's really, it truly is anyone. Anyone can be trafficked. I mean, even the co-founder of my organization, who is a survivor, she's not someone who anyone would ever look at and think, oh, I bet she was a victim of trafficking. You know, she has multiple degrees. Her family was very well known in the community. You know, they were very financially well off. She had a lot of opportunity, but she was preyed upon. She had other types of vulnerabilities that were taken advantage of. So it can really be anything, any socioeconomic background, any education background, any ethnicity. The only thing I can say for certain is that we do know that marginalized populations definitely are at much higher risk. They experience trafficking at much higher rates.
So what would you describe as a marginalized population?
Well, here in Wyoming, a big one for us is our Native American population. We know, like, the missing, murdered Indigenous mm-hmm. peoples movement is such a real thing.
And that's just across the border.
Yeah. I mean, it's all around us. We're 30 minutes from the Crow here, but we've got Wink River right in the middle of our state. We've got all of the Native American tribes that are in, you know, South Dakota, North Dakota. It's all around us in our region, and they're a very exploited group of people. Our BIPOC community, of course, very highly exploited LGBTQ.
Could you explain BIPOC?
BIPOC is basically people of color.
Right.
So
thank you. It's not a term that I think many people are familiar with. So thank you.
Yeah, being in the field, I think I just like spout off all the acronyms. Yes. But yeah, people of color, and like the LGBTQ, especially youth. And right now it's really scary, you know, some of the things I see legislatively and stuff that might make that youth feel even more isolated. What is a youth going to do when they feel isolated and like they don't belong and that no one wants them? They're probably going to like turn to other means for interaction, like going online. And that just leads them right into the hands of people.
So is online, is that remote access, is that more prevalent, do you think, in our communities than person on person?
It's really hard to say. At this point, I would wager that it's just easier online. It can happen faster, quicker, because the access is just insane now. Like, every kid has a phone. So I think it's a little easier that that could happen in our communities. But it's hard to say for certain if it's happening more than in-person stuff, because the amount of disclosures and cases I've seen in Wyoming alone, like it's more than people would realize. And we haven't even popped the lid or popped open the can of worms, so to speak, on things like labor trafficking, where we know there are certain industries that are known to have higher prevalences of labor trafficking across the U.S. and their industries like tourism, agriculture, extraction, construction, manufacturing, all things that we have in Wyoming. And no one's even really starting to look at that in Wyoming yet. And so when it comes to something like labor trafficking, if I were to take an educated guess, I would guess we have more labor trafficking in Wyoming than we'll ever have sex trafficking. But no one's even looking at that yet. So I don't really know, but I think online is huge right now. It's a huge problem.
So Wyoming prides itself on being a close-knit community, you know, one town separated by a long road, essentially. Do you think that's makes it trafficking easier or harder
both.
In our communities?
Both. I think for something like familial trafficking, it can thrive in that environment, because when our communities are so close and everyone knows everyone, that person who might be exploiting their family member, they know who they can sell to and who they can't, so that they can get away with it and they can go undetected. They have reputations in their community. You know, you think about something like, I think it was last year, ICAC arrested a city councilman in Grable, just over the mountain. He was selling child sexual abuse material on the internet, if you're curious. 10 photos for $100 worth of Bitcoin was his rate. And whenever he was arrested and they were interviewing the other council members, they were all like, what? There's no way. He's such a good guy. So people can get really far based on reputation in small towns, I feel like. And so it's easy that people will never think that you were doing something like that. So in that sense, I think certain types of trafficking could really thrive and go unnoticed in our communities. But on the other hand, it's a huge strength because we are so small, our population is so few, like we can really do a lot with awareness and education and building safety nets and strengthening communities so that everyone is looking out for each other and looking out for this. And that could go a heck of a long way in Wyoming. And then even on, I'm a preventionist at heart, I think. I want to stop this problem before it starts. And so even something like looking at why do we have trafficking? It's really there because there's a demand. There's people who want to purchase this material, who want to purchase sex, who want to purchase children. If we really shook up and addressed demand in a state like Wyoming, if we had law enforcement agencies who are regularly running operations geared at demand so that people were scared to buy sex here because they never knew if they were going to get the real thing or they were going to get a cop, like that could really eradicate a lot of demand in a state like ours because of our size. So it's both a strength and a weakness, but I like to be optimistic and err more on the side of, I think it's more of a strength if we can really harness it and come together.
And I know that ICAC, you mentioned ICAC again, and they do actually go online and they do pose as young people, and they do try and, you know,
and there's other agencies too
that are doing that too. So, surviving something like that, does Uprising get involved in helping survivors?
So technically, no. Our agency is more of an upstream agency. We are not a victim-serving agency. However, because we're in Wyoming and we're one of very few people who do this work here, we do get a lot of calls. You know, I had a call last week from a law enforcement agency in another area of the state who they just had a case come up and they had a victim and they were like, we don't know where we can actually get this victim help. And so, of course, we're not going to do nothing. So we try to utilize our network of people that we work with across the U.S. to find out, like, where would the best place for this person be? Is there anywhere close by that has space in their program for them? We have some private donors and volunteers across the state who are willing to do things like, if there's not funding, to pay to get a survivor out of state to a program that would be good for them, they will help cover those costs so that they can get them somewhere. Also, all of our domestic violence sexual assault programs across the state, which there's one in every single county, they will serve a victim of trafficking. Sometimes they might not have what they need, so that's hard, but we try to work with what we have in our state. And I think it's going to be getting to the point where now we've done so much training, so much awareness, and what naturally comes after years of awareness and training is that people start to identify it more. Not that it's happening more, it was always there, but they're seeing it now. And I think naturally the need for human trafficking specific victim services will probably be something that comes up in the next several years.
So you've mentioned several times survivors. Is it possible to survive and thrive? Or is this
absolutely
a lifelong sentence that you never get out from underneath?
Well, it's kind of both again, because it's definitely something that is going to affect someone for the rest of their lives. I've learned that by working very closely with many survivors. This trauma never goes away, and it's something that they're constantly working on healing and just staying on top of. But I know so many amazing survivors who are absolutely thriving. They're doing amazing things, and a lot of them who even come back into the field to try to make a difference and stop it. And that's probably the greatest joy of the work I do. And the thing that really keeps me going is getting to work alongside of these survivors and elevate their voices and hire them and, you know, get to see them live out their passions really makes it worth it in the end and gives you a little bit of hope, because it can be daunting to look at this problem.
It's a horrible problem, and I think it creates very, very strong emotions and repulsion in many, many people, and also sadness. I mean, intense sadness, you know, just how horrible and tragic this issue is. Thank you so much for spending some time and talking to us and being prepared to work in this very, very difficult field. Is there anything else that people should know about Uprising and the work you're doing, and maybe they can contact you if they've got a concern? How do you like to take calls and so on?
Well, you can always find us. The best way is our website. It's uprisingwyo.org. We're also on all the social media things. We are pretty easy to find, especially being the only anti-trafficking agency that's really doing a lot in the state of Wyoming. So we have opportunities for volunteers. We have resources on our website. We constantly are doing events and training across the state. If you want to bring us to your community, we love that. Just drop us a line, and we are there. We will find a way to schedule it and make it work. And then my last thought that I like to really leave people with is there's really, if we want to actually make a dent in the issue of human trafficking, there's two key things that we really need to focus on. One is the demand side, because we need to end the demand.
Let's just pause for a moment on that, because in a sense, some people may say, you're just trying to turn off human nature. You know, this is human nature that you're trying to kind of push back on. That's not even possible. Don't even bother to try.
Oh, I don't believe that for a second. I know way more people who aren't out there trying to purchase sex or harm children or anyone than who are, absolutely. And I see a lot of the bad side of stuff. So for me to say that, I feel like, as jaded as I am being in this field, is something. There's still way more good out there than bad. But the demand, it's almost like anything else. And I've been able to be on, you know, we've done a few sting operations with law enforcement, for example, and I've got to interview the sex buyers at the point they were arrested. And we're constantly trying to do more research on the area, because I want to stop demand. So I need to know what's driving demand. And a lot of the stuff that's driving these people, they have very poor connection. Like, they don't feel they have any true connection. They often tell us they're there because they're coping with something, you know, their failed marriage, the work stress, the things that they just can't cope any other way than buying sex. 100% of the buyers that I've ever talked to across the board are addicted to pornography. We know there's a lot of research on pornography that shows it's just like any other drug. You need harder and harder stuff to get the same high, and that's often, that I believe, the thing that probably leads them down the road where they eventually want to purchase sex in person. Or they get into these more hardcore taboo things like children and stuff.
Of course, I think it's worth pointing out that those things are so readily available on your phone. Mm-hmm. You know, you've basically got a walking, you know, pornography encyclopedia just sitting there, and you just click and go, and it can be done very privately. You know, you don't have to have much tech savviness to be able to do
it. Any age can access it. Yes. You can access it accidentally as a youth, mm-hmm. or maybe you're curious and you type something in, and then you're exposed to something way worse than what you were searching for. You know, we have kids Googling boobs on the school bus at home. It could start as innocently as that. And what people don't realize is how addictive it actually is, and especially for an underdeveloped brain of a youth. And so that's a big thing that we spend a lot of time talking to youth about. They don't realize the harms of pornography. No one talks about pornography to them. It's like a hush-hush topic. And I'm more along the lines of, like, there are age-appropriate ways to talk to almost any age kid about pornography so that you can protect them. Because the other thing about, I feel like we're getting off on a tangent, but the other last thing I'll say about pornography is so many of the survivors of child sexual abuse that I've met, not just through trafficking work, but through other work that I do in that field, a lot of them were groomed using pornography. So a lot of times the exploiter is force feeding youth pornography because it will sort of desensitize them and train them, so to speak, on what eventually they're going to have to do. So when they go to that youth and say, I want you to do X, Y, and Z, it's not such a shocking thing anymore because they've been watching pornography for months. And I have had youth that we work with who've told me, like, I was addicted to porn at age 9. You know, it's just insane how harmful it is and how predators know how to utilize it. So,
well, and of course, you mentioned a very important point that probably we should have discussed, which is that it doesn't just happen overnight one day. You know, suddenly you find yourself a victim or a perpetrator, perhaps. There is a grooming process involved. Yep. And I think that's a term that many people are familiar with now, the idea of grooming. But in the same way, there is a grooming process.
Yeah, it's a person who is literally tactfully deploying different things on this child to try to get them ready to be exploited. Mm-hmm. And we do an insane amount of training about grooming, especially for parents, educators, anyone who's working with youth and youth themselves. I think that's a key thing because I've seen some of the harms of just kids who didn't even actually end up getting exploited, but who experience some intense grooming, and there's a lot of psychological grooming, and that doesn't go away. That's a trauma that stays with them for years. I've seen entire families just ripped apart because of a kid who was groomed online through, you know, a Roblox app. And suddenly now parents are getting divorced and they're in financial stress, and mom has had to give up custody to the state to be able to get her child into a program to get help. And the program maybe helped the kid in some ways, but also started to cause more issues in other ways. And so it's just a whole vicious cycle. Even to get that far is terrifying. So, but the good news is there's often some really clear signs in grooming that you can identify that that's potentially happening. And so we like to train people about what grooming looks like.
Terry, thank you very much indeed for your time. You've given us a walk into a kind of terrifying, disturbing forest for a moment, but I think it's one that we need to be aware of.
Yes.
And thank you for all the work you're doing, and for spending some time with 307net Radio.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about it.